You got this in front of you. If I remember it correctly. Sometimes I leave words out of English sentences. And this is for those that don't have the handouts. And changed in election. Glory of the not corruptible God in or into likeness or a likeness, an icon, a likeness icon, corruptible. And doctor here, because it goes on with anthropo, man, and birds, and quadrupeds, and reptiles. King James has it, corruptible man, birds, four-footed beasts, and creeping things. And I start the next verse, the 24th. Wherefore God also gave them up. And I'm going to get to that in a few minutes. Gave them up. And I scribbled some notes of my own underneath the little insert. I've handed the same verse out for many weeks, but I'm moving to the bridge to the next verses now. Paradokon. I'll do much with that word later in the message. But this "and" lets you know this is just the tail end of these people's condition. That's why the insert has several verses in the King James to review the territory we covered and have spent weeks on. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in him. And this follows earlier verses where having euphorically proclaimed the gospel. And you know, we've come a long ways. We're well over 100 messages on this first chapter. And you may be forgetting those days when you thought you knew what evangel meant, or evangelism meant, or you thought you knew what righteousness meant, and you thought you knew what gospel meant. And we unpack those words to the glorious description of Christianity that can be done, not the self-defeating, impossible to attain standard of righteousness where we're measured by that absolute criterion. We spent so much time, and if you'll put it in context, I'm going to read something in a couple of moments and you'll see it's still the same problem. Do we define righteousness? And God have to conform, or do we create the standards of righteousness and tell God what it has to be? Or does he? And you remember the weeks driving home the thought as we traced righteousness from a Greek goddess personified, that evil daughter of Zeus, Dike, clear through the objectification into some abstract law. We poke fun at a modern attorney who tells us that God learned by trial and error, and finally approached the standard of righteousness and law that this lawyer could approve. The issue is, if God exists, and by definition, if God exists, he's all-powerful, because that's what keeps him God. Whatever he says goes. Whatever he does is righteous. Now, we'd like that to be our state of being. I mean, I know some self-righteous church people that think that when they break wind, it's righteous. That woke you up, didn't it? You know, it's amazing how people will flee the bathroom when someone else uses it. And they just camp out in there in their own perfume. You ever notice that? There's something special about their odoriferousness. That's the way a lot of Christians are about their righteousness. It smells good to them. Are you getting there? Are you with me? No, you're coming around finally? God's the only one that can view that way about himself. In fact, the only person, if he exists, for which self-centeredness is righteousness, is God. The only person for whom it is proper for that person to expect to be worshipped, God. In other words, get off of it. If God doesn't exist, forget it. My definition of righteousness is as good as yours. And perfume sales begin on a scale that starts of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst and 10 being the less. My bathroom is a 10. You may not forget this if I keep going on it. Well, you don't talk about these things. That's just the way we are. I mean, there's a street term. I can't say it on TV. You know, you see these people, they think they're bleep don't bleep. Right? Well, God thinks his bleep doesn't bleep, and it, you better say it doesn't. You got it? Oh, no. We project onto God that he must be right and proper for our standards. If God exists, I am that I am, he said. I define righteousness. And this whole series that we dealt with on righteousness before we came to the 17th and 18th verses was pulling the traditions apart that make void the Word of God, and understanding that God defines righteousness, and he says we all fall short, period. We ain't righteous by his standard. He gave a law to prove it to us. That's why Paul calls it a schoolmaster. The right understanding of the law is to see it as a schoolmaster, that when we see it, it gives us a knowledge of our sin. And then God, who has the right to do what he wants, demonstrates his faithfulness by bearing the consequences so that we would never think he wavers on his word. And then he defines a righteousness we can do. Trust. And the gospel unleashes the kingdom of God with power. The one who died for us rose again, and at the right hand of the Father stands ready to distribute in us the righteousing factor, a measure of his own life that does the righteousing as a gift. If we trust him, the trust has this peculiar quality about it. It's like love that can grow cold. Trust has to be maintained. And thus the Christian life is a life from faith to faith, because God intends to people the garden of his heart in eternity with sons and daughters that will trust him, the firstborn of that family being the one who trusted him to raise him on the third day. And that's the glorious good news of the gospel, is that God has covered our sins, and God has borne the consequences of our unrighteous behavior and given us a new way, that if we will trust him, from faith to faith he'll lead us home. And having made it so easy, the slow boil of his anger at his creation, driving him out of the garden and eliminating him and setting themselves up as gods, at the same time unleashes wrath. Not wrath to come, wrath now. And that wrath is on everyone who blind themselves, and that's what it is. This will be about the how many hundred times I've quoted Sproul, who says atheism is a state of mind. The same state of mind that makes us want to define righteousness instead of bowing before his righteousness. The same state of mind that wants to put God on trial, even if they recognize him, like the Israelites, when we're on trial. The same state of mind that was given everything in the garden, Adam and Eve, who wanted the garden with no restrictions. The state of mind that wants to be God in God's place. And as long as you are open to his presence and recognize his presence, you can't be God yourself. And these passages start with God simply declaring he's fed up. It's like those that argue with whether or not his righteousness is the best righteousness as revealed. He's fed up. He apparently put in all creation some faculty that can at least recognize his presence, his reality, from what he made. This is the old watchmaker concept. You go down a street, or down a path, a mountain path, Paley's famous illustration that produced the counterbalance of Dawkins, the sharp-tongued, arrogant British spokesman for Darwinism, that then writes a book on the blind watchmaker, that it can happen by chance. Paley's argument, you go along a mountain path and you kick a rock, it's not going to elicit instantly an unusual question. This had to be made by someone. But you kick a leaf and there's a swish watch ticking and keeping time. An intelligent person says, a watchmaker is involved in this. This could not happen by chance. Now that's a pretty good illustration for Paul's day, when rocks were pretty solid objects and considered the common sense view of them. But the condemnation from God is even more justified as modern science has probed to atoms, the Greeks, that word comes from a Greek word which means indivisible. You can't divide it. Now we split and break atoms. And down to electrons, protons, nuclei, and quarks, and primordial soup, and photons. All the more when we realize that rock is perfectly balanced, more space than what we view as solid matter. And yet, a rock is perfection well beyond the schoolboy attitude of how complicated a Swiss watch is. Swiss watch is using those same elements and arranging them, but they were arranged before he got there. A molecule has arrangements beyond the simple concept of a rock, watch that's made. And with modern science, you break the watch down to the molecular elements and physics that make it up. God has fed up. He's saying, the only reason you're leaving me out of it is you don't want me to exist. The only reason you don't want to recognize that this could not happen by chance is you don't want to have to deal with the watchmaker. It is a perverse state of mind that simply refuses to see what God views as obvious. I mean, figure it out. Let's simplify it. If you made the watch or paid a good price for it and lost it, I think, let's stick with you made it. If you made the watch, I think you'd be offended at some dodo that thinks that it just happened like a rock. If you were raising a child and you have this big, beautiful pocket watch and you dropped it, and the kid comes in and doesn't see the difference between this watch and a rock he just picked up, you and the kid are going to have a talk. In fact, most kids know that marbles don't just happen. Otherwise, you'd be out there just picking rocks up and shooting them around, drawing a circle. I used to play marbles when I was a kid. I was good. And I'd come home with keepers. I'd come home with a bunch of marbles, and there were a few guys took them from me. That's the way it was in elementary school in that rough little town. But when my granddad got done with me and I figured out what he had done to me was worse than what they could have done, people slowly learned, don't try to take the marbles back on the way home from school from little Gene, because he's ready to die for those marbles. But Grandpa convinced me if I let him get away with it again, I would die when I got home. God fed up. That's what these lessons have been about. And God has said, because they won't recognize, and it's not just for those heathen, and I'm so tired of this subject, I want to go on, God won't let me go on because I keep knowing that there's a point where I'll sense the congregation really understands what's being done to this generation and your children with this tunnel we've talked about of scientism taking over the frame of reference of the world and their own creation story replacing the biblical story. And in this tunnel, your kids are trapped. They can't get an education. It's time somebody make some noise about it. God's been making noise. Scientism, if you'll remember in this review, it's the ism I don't like that makes it a religion. The scientific method, the ultimate way to truth, and this natural world is all that there is. And the only place we're going to find truth, to quote Sagan again, the cosmos is all that there ever was, all that there is, and all that there ever will be. And there is no truth and no method of finding truth outside of science. That made it a religion. What's terrible is it gained a reputation until education bought their philosophy and marginalized and moved any belief in the supernatural out. Law bought it, and the media proclaims it. And we live in this tunnel where when a scientist speaks, it's the equivalent of a priest in the Middle Ages speaking. As uncritically analyzed as a priest in the Middle Ages. If a scientist says it, it has to be true. Science, I have no quarrel with. These electric lights, this microphone, this screen, the stent in my heart. I have no quarrel with science, but its successes and the fact that the Church of the Middle Ages wrongfully sought to suppress science. They've reacted like rebellious kids that got out of the fence. And they've taken over. And the proclamations of science are fact. And anything that has to do with God is religion. And by that slick little separation, religion is fantasy, and science is fact. And science can be trusted and is objective and verifiable. And religion is subjective, incapable of being verified, fantasy, and for the weak in the head. That's what they've accomplished. And you have the snide, patronizing media people at Christmas and Easter trying to show their brilliant religion of no religion, expertise in comparative religions, when they don't know a Quran from a can, and a Bible from a bib. They're just being religious for the moment to patronize these second-level citizens out here. God is saying, I've had it. I left enough obvious indices of my presence. A blind watchmaker cannot make from scratch, by chance, a blind mousetrap maker couldn't have assembled it by chance, much less a Swiss watch. It takes intelligent design. That's all Paul is saying. Intelligent design. and a designer capable of doing this is to be respected and recognized and worshiped. And with our historic experience with tyrannical power rulers, one that powerful that hasn't wiped us out in our heart of hearts because of our sins, is to be worshiped and thanked. And the absence of this attitude of recognizing his power, respecting and worshiping him and thanking him, produces a wrath that takes from whomever's guilty of trifling with that knowledge you have, that general knowledge. Most of these scientists have full knowledge of the Christian revelation. But whatever your knowledge, you trifle with it and mock God by ignoring his presence, not recognizing and living with a conscious awareness that he is, worshiping and thanking him, he pulls something out of you. A faculty that I call the God sense. He makes your heart senseless, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it to them. That's what the creation is. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood with the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. So they're without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, nor were thankful, but became vain. And I've given you that word, circle it on your notes, circle vain, it's metaios. It is self-deception. It is self-aggrandizement, vanity. It is putting yourself first and deceiving yourself that your way and your ideas and your thoughts and your creation, which is the concepts that you come up with to deny God, those empty, self-serving ideas, vain in their imaginations, no, dialogue is the root word, vain and self-deceiving and self-serving and self-elevating use of words to achieve that self-deification, creating out of the vanity of your own self-worship ideas that you float, and as God created the world with his word and will bless through the word and has given to us that marvelous ability to have dialogue, which in eternity separates the Christian faith from the Eastern religions, where you find God in nothingness. There is always the dialogue of praising around his throne. Persons know one another by words, and God chose to bless us. The word is the root from which we get eulogy. His method of revealing himself, his method of redemption is the eternal word comes to do it. These vain self-serving, defying the Creator and putting himself up as supreme in self-serving use of this wonderful gift. I'm going to tell you something. By the foolishness of preaching, by the word of God, there is no gift as precious as this gift of language, the capacity to communicate. In the history of the world, big muscles don't have a chance against even nation-swaying oratory. The power of words is why God chose preaching to communicate his gospel. And there is no worse prostitution of the greatest gift that's been given to any of you, the conceptual ability. Obviously a gift from God, because it's most active in children. You will never see the day you can learn a language as fast as a child. It's like there's the evolutionist talk to what point to certain organs in our body that they say are vestigial remnants, useless organs left behind in the evolutionary chain. Certain glands. For years they thought the appendix were nothing. Medicine has long ago concluded the tonsils. But as biology and medicine increases, they find certain glands serve a certain purpose at a certain stage of your development. Certain glands were designed precisely to be active during the early years of childhood. They're not just vestigial remnants of evolution. They're part of a mosaic that play their part like a symbol that only hits once or twice versus the lead violins that keep playing. And there is something in children that early on is a faculty God-given for this gift of language. And the greatest curse was not really putting man out there to work. The evil and the hurts and the nationalism and the fights and the wars and the separations when God confused the languages and changed it from one language. This is a gift from God. And there's nothing that you can prostitute more aggravatingly than for vain, self-deceiving, self-serving, self-elevating purposes, use this great gift to create dialogue that elevates you in place of God. That's why repentance requires with the heart man believeth, with the mouth profession is made in that turning from. These evil people, because God has taken from them the faculty to even see Him if He stands in front of them, they would call it something else. He has removed, that's His wrath now, and it can happen to anyone, any one of us, who deliberately trivializes the knowledge of God to keep ourselves front and center. You become vain, empty, self-serving, and your dialogues spew out, using words to glorify self. And the result is, God says, foolish heart is darkened. God takes your senseless heart. He makes it a senseless heart and darkens it until you can't even see God. And in that state, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and having ruled God out, put in the place of the glory of God, which is not dying, not decaying, eternal, non-corruptible, icons that die. And I've spent about 3 or 4 weeks now trying to wedge into our consciousness so you don't tune out and plan the Sunday activity. This is not just a happening in a heathen society that carves out an image out of wood. These are icons carved out with words that replace as the object of worship images that point to something other than God to be revered, respected, and recognized as the Creator of all things. It's putting, as the next verse will say, on down a couple, it's worshiping the creation, the creature, rather than the Creator. Indeed, it's making the creature the Creator. And putting in the place of the Creator, using self-serving words, because I'm the breakthrough scientist who comes up with this idea with God's sense removed and refusing to recognize God because that requires me to bow, I become supreme as the mouthpiece who dialogue sends out with words this concept that can be reduced now to pictures and icons and reverent places in museums. And I am to show respect and amazement and revere and march by and quiver with wonder that these represent my ancestors, my source, my root. And I have instant fame, not having a new relationship with God, finding another supporting illustration of a new shape of the icon. Icons are representations of that which is worshipped. And the icons are just as real today in museums and textbooks as when they were carved out in ancient days. Let me, with that review, dive in now to the illustration of these senseless logicians. To coin a word, these sense, God sense vacant mouthpieces of dialogues conceptually creating new icons of worship in the place and to the belittlement and to the removal from anywhere in the respected frame that the tunnel encompasses of a faith in God. Let me read Reason and the Balance by Philip Johnson. Darwinian evolution. Now, I don't think I have to read again all of the quotes that are in the textbooks. Darwinism is a fact. It has been proven. Life can be formed in a test tube. Some primordial soup, Miller-Urey experiment. The embryos, Haeckel's drawings in the textbook. Recapitulate the evolutionary history of mankind. Even though the Miller-Urey experiment was an oxygen-free tube where he'd have blown his head off, and it postulates an oxygen-free atmosphere on the earth when life began, and even the neo-Darwinists no longer accept that, because there's never been an oxygen-free atmosphere ever on this earth. The embryos were faked, proven fraud. The drawings are fake, not the embryos. The drawings are fake. The peppered moths, the best term is peppered myths. They don't nest on the tree trunks. And doesn't prove anything more than Darwin's finches that he spent no time with, which is adjustments and weeding out of the weak and changing of what can survive and not survive in an oscillating environment. Nobody argues that if you have to get up every morning and lift 100 pounds with a little finger, or you're shot, no doubt Shaq will be the only one living at the end of the month. Shaq O'Neal. I guess he must turn pounds his finger, I don't know. I mean, nobody argues with adjustments within the species that's affected by environment, happenings, mutations that normally are bad, not good. But there's been no demonstration of change from species to species. Fraud. You go to an exhibit up in San Francisco and they have pictures of fossils and things in one of the exhibits. And there's a big map there where these fossils are found. And the tree of life is being shown. And they have different fossils, pictures of them, and magnifying glasses hanging there for you to look at. And then you come to the hard facts display. The magnifying glasses are hanging right at the point where the branches go off, which is where a species has to change. And most people are not going to go look because, you know, behind every magnifying glass and the rest of the display, there's a fossil. But all these magnifying glasses in the hard facts display are at the branches. And you go look at the magnifying glasses and there's nothing behind it. Because there are no hard facts. And it's a real subtle display, because if you just walk by fast, you'll think, well, boy, they found the fossils that connect all of these. But if you look at the hard facts and go look where the species connections are taken off, there ain't any fossils. Hard facts are no connecting link. I've been on it enough weeks. Let me now get right to this. Darwinian evolution is not primarily important as a scientific theory, but that's what most of you thought, isn't it? Isn't that what we're taught? It's primarily important as a scientific theory, supported by scientific facts. How many have been told that? It's not primarily important as a scientific theory, but rather as a culturally dominant creation story, a religious myth. Every culture must have a creation story as a basis for things like philosophy, education, and law. Philosophy, education, and law. If we want to know how we ought to lead our lives and relate to our fellow creatures, the place to begin is with knowledge about how and why we came into existence. When there is radical disagreement in the Commonwealth about the creation story, the stage is set for intense conflict, the kind of conflict that's known as a culture war. Like the Reformation and the Renaissance that changed the face of Europe. And that's why we're seeing a stage set for culture war, and it's bad, on issues such as abortion. For many centuries, Western civilization in Europe and America, our heritage, was based on a creation story that said we are created by an omnipotent and omniscient being called God, who brought about our existence for a purpose and who is actively concerned with what we do. And this is why I almost skipped over this series in Romans, because this congregation has been taught by me for 26 years. You haven't changed your view of the Creator. But your kids are going to be turned loose into a world. Let me finish. You'll see the world. For many centuries, Western civilization was based on a creation story that said we're created by an omnipotent and omniscient being called God, who brought about our existence for a purpose, and who is actively concerned with what we do. When a creation story of this kind is generally accepted, it follows that the most important knowledge to have is knowledge of the Creator's purposes, knowledge of the Creator Himself, what the Creator has done and plans to do. Knowledge of the workings of material processes like gravity and blood circulation may be valuable, but still more valuable is knowledge about the ultimate values and purposes behind the mechanisms of physics and biology. These are the values and purposes of the Creator. Am I boring you? In the mid-1800s, when Darwinism conquered, in the 19th and 20th centuries, a very different creation story replaced the traditional one. First among the most highly educated elites, and gradually in the society as a whole. The new creation story said it is not true. Now, they will not say this quite this blatantly. They just say it without quite saying it in most of the textbooks. They still have to be funded by taxpayers. They're going to warp the minds of your kids as reconstructionists in education without making it obvious. But this is the philosophy. It's the philosophy behind experimentalism, which produced progressive education. And John Dewey's humanist manifesto in 19th and 20th centuries, a very different creation story. That's why creation and creator, and that's why I'm camping out on this, is so critical. A very different creation story replaced the traditional one. The new creation story said, listen, it is not true that God created us. On the contrary, our, I'll add, dumb ancestors created God out of their pre-scientific imagination. According to the new story, all living creatures evolved by an unguided, purposeless, material process of random genetic change and natural selection. This naturalistic creation story implies that knowledge of the Creator's mind and purpose is inherently illusory. The true Creator, evolution, has no mind or purpose. What is important to us is not why we exist. In any case, no knowledge is available about a subject like that, but rather how we can learn to control our physical and social environment in order to increase our safety and happiness. There you are. But they go beyond just the simple statement of the philosophy that's that glaring and that real. And you may say, well, I don't care about this. I believe in God. When pragmatism determines and utility determines the value of life, looking at the face of some of you, you'd be the first to go. Do you sleep? You want to stay awake or you want to leave? Take the colored glasses off and leave them off. Now, anybody can go to sleep, but you better be grateful for being waked up. Understood? I run a tough class. You got a good attitude. That's okay. Anybody can go to sleep. It's how you act when I wake you up. Well, I'll tell you something. From here on, those color, I have to wear the colored glasses because these bright lights are right in my eyes, and worse when you get behind that. And when you have as many years as I have, you've got a problem. But even the colored glasses I choose, you can see a little bit of my eyes behind it. From now on, anybody wearing colored glasses in here is going to be suspect. If you got glasses that dark, I better see some movement. I better see a smile, better see a head nod, and not at the wrong time. That's the philosophy, I'm telling you folks. Then how can there be any morality except what works? And what, that you got a generation of them. You wonder what's the problem with this generation? I've told you this probably 1,000 times since I've been here. I studied under the leading exponent of John Dewey, who brought this philosophy into education. Pragmatism. Experimentalism is the philosophy. There is no reality other than the sea of life. Your individuality is no more real than a wave in the sea. And your existence has no value other than the ability to trickle along and last your waveness out as long as you can. There are no absolute facts. The only absolute truth, there's only one absolute truth. That is the absolute truth that there are no absolute truths. There's only one unchanging fact, the fact that everything changes. That what you learn is not as important as how you learn, and since there are no truths and no objective facts, only that which works to give you happiness is the criteria of value, and truth is that which works for you. And value is that which satisfies you, and you become the center of your universe, and your universe has this little temporary time. And the end justifies the means, the end being your happiness, and lying becomes a mode. Because there are no absolute truths, so how do you know the difference between a lie and the truth? Truth is that which works for you. We're surrounded by it. It affects every area of our society. It affects the work ethic. It affects the ability to keep contracts and keep faith. It affects every dimension of our society. We're reaping the harvest. In a president that was the most popular president, who could outlie the father of liars. Who had his own definition of sex. I did not have sex with that woman. Sex to me is whatever you didn't catch me doing. If you caught me, that ain't sex. If we had videotaped close-ups of copulation, how do I get away with this? You'd say I didn't come to the party. anybody asleep now? Look what you would have missed. You go around through life, and these elitists that have reconstructed society have created this tunnel you live and work in. And they've gotten more bold now. I'm going to read a few more of these things I said the other day. I'm going to show you how evil they are. They are liars, con artists, vain dialogicians, sucking us into their egomaniac icons of their creation, wanting us to worship that instead of them. I'm going to reread the fury of Dawkins, the lead spokesman on the British side, their great museum where Darwin is worshipped as a saint. I want to read his fury again. I read it last Sunday, but it bears repeating. Listen to this. This anti-religious viewpoint. The religious viewpoint, if Darwinism is the religion, from Darwin on Trial by Philip E. Johnson, the attorney and law professor from Cal. According to Dawkins, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. I read this last Sunday, but maybe I went by too fast until the end of the message. When he contemplates the perfidy, or evil, of those who refuse to believe, he sounds like a preacher. Evolution is not a fact, it's a theory. And now they demand faith. And the Inquisition today is ostracized out of the respected community. The mental midgets, the mob that we have to tolerate because the majority of America still believes in God. But science has got a halo, and the general attitude of the public is analogous to the attitude of third world countries, uncritical of anything. If the Pope shows up, if the Pope says it, it's God talking. He's the vicar of Christ. The Pope said it. That's it. In this country, though the majority believe in God, if scientists say it, it must be true, and if it conflicts with my religion, I don't want to think about it. The father of our current Attorney General, Robert Ashcroft, his father, J. Robert Ashcroft, one of my closest friends, president of Evangel College, they needed their accreditation. It was J. Robert, the current Robert Ashcroft's father, that persuaded me to adjust my schedules and teach a full 16 units on Tuesday and Wednesday, just 2 days. And they adjusted the schedules of the school in those days so I could add another PhD from Stanford to their faculty as they sought accreditation. Bob and I used to spend hours talking. One of the greatest song leaders. I understand where his son gets the singing ability in that Senate quartet that they sang in. And J. Robert, when he would lead this song service in the General Council conventions, could enliven the whole audience. But he was working on his doctorate in psychology, he didn't have it finished. We used to go long hours. And he would say to me, "Gene, I've just never been able to synthesize my psychological training, my academic training, with my religious faith." And I was teaching pastor at Central Assembly, the headquarters church at that time, also when we were having this conversation. And he would so often lead the song service and enliven the church service on Sunday morning. And he'd say, "I just quit fighting it. I can't reconcile my academic presuppositions and training, which he would teach in his classes, with my religious faith. But I know what I feel on Sunday. So I just shut it out of my mind when Sunday comes and revel in the Spirit and worship in the church. And when I go into the classroom on Monday, I shut that out and teach what I've been programmed to teach. I still remember it. I said, Bob, that's immoral. You've got to reconcile it one way or the other. And we were good friends. We got away with that kind of exchange. I don't know if he ever did. But that's the way most Christians are. You send your kids, you expose them to this. And there are parents who would rather take their kids to a church where they can turn them loose in some social event and get Christianity by proxy put in your kids and wonder why they lose them, because they're growing up in a church that shouts and jumps and dances in the Spirit on Sunday and then accepts evolution as a fact the rest of the week and gives science respect they do not deserve. When Dawkins contemplates the evil of those who refuse to believe, evolution that is, he can hardly restrain his fury. Quote, it is absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that. Then he went on to explain, by the way, that what he dislikes particularly about creationists who believe God created it is that they're intolerant. Let me give you another one. From this same book, Darwin on Trial, British Museum of Natural History is located in a magnificent Victorian building in Greater London's South Kensington district. Any of you ever been there? Oh, quite a few. They celebrated the centennial in 1981 by opening a new exhibition on Darwin's theory. I want you to see a modern kind of Jesuit inquisition. Once the religion is established, dissent is not allowed. Questions are not allowed. We can't burn them at the stake, they would say, but they can ostracize them. One of the first things a visitor encountered as it opened on entering the exhibit was a sign which read as follows. Quote, have you ever wondered why there are so many different kinds of living things? One idea is that all the living things we see today have evolved, capital letters, from a distant ancestor by a process of gradual change. How could evolution have occurred? How could one species change into another? The exhibition in this hall looks at one possible explanation, the explanation of Charles Darwin. An adjacent poster included the statement that, quote, another view is that God created all living things perfect and unchanging. A brochure asserted that, quote, the concept of evolution by natural selection is not, strictly speaking, scientific, because it's been established by logical deduction rather than empirical demonstration. No missing links, for example. No process of life forming spontaneously in a non-oxygen-free atmosphere. It's never been tested. Just logical deduction. The brochure observed that if the theory of evolution is true, it provides an explanation for the groups within groups arrangement of nature described by taxonomists. The general tenor of the exhibit when it opened was that Darwinism is an important theory, but not something which it is unreasonable to doubt. Prominent scientists reacted furiously to these relativistic expressions. One leading Darwinist, L.B. Halstead, charged that some of the exhibits could be interpreted as attacking not only Darwinism, but evolution itself. For example, he found that, and he reacted, that the exhibit, when it opened on man's place in evolution, specifically denied that Homo erectus was a direct ancestor of Homo sapiens, so that what the creationists have insisted on for years is now being openly advertised by the Natural History Museum, that we, Homo erectus. You gotta go very close with this. But be very careful now. Did not descend from the bent over group and the knuckle walking group. Those knuckle walkers were not Homo erectus. You can do what you want. Aren't you glad you woke up? And it was not creationists. Watch the way, like rabid dogs. This is the priests reacting to Luther, questioning indulgences. They're the religion today. And heresy will not be allowed, not even to be proclaimed in the street corners. It was not the creationists that Halstead blamed for these transgressions. It's the Marxists, he said. Marxists tend, see, they fight dirty. Like Dawkins, who hates the creationists because they're intolerant. But if you don't believe in evolution, you are stupid, insane, or wicked. Though I hate to use that phrase. It's not the creationists that caused this terrible stain on our national museum and questioning evolution. It's the Marxists. Marxists tend to prefer a model of evolutionary change that proceeds by rapid bursts rather than constant gradulation, or gradualism, because it fits with their view that social change occurs by a revolutionary leap from one kind of state to another. Halstead presented no concrete evidence of any Marxist motivation among the museum scientists, but he asserted that the museum was either unwittingly or willingly giving support to Marxist theory by casting doubt upon Darwinist gradualism. The charge of political motivation was good entertainment, but the substantial issue was that the museum staff was going public with doubts about neo-Darwinism and even the existence of fossil ancestors. Doubts that had previously been expressed in professional journals. But these are magazines the general public doesn't read. You don't trouble the general public with the facts. Specifically, I mean, these were questions that were only talked about in professional circles. But we must come together. Like a family, we can fight as a family, but if any outsider comes in, we're together. We can't allow a crack in the door to question evolution. Well, now, how about one of the scientific methods was you propose a hypothesis, you experiment, and dozens of experiments can be undone by one incongruity or anomaly that falsifies it. You're not allowed to consider the possibility now that it's false, except among we elite that can discuss these matters, because we know it's just, educational exercise to find new ways to perfect our theory. But to the public, it's fact. Specifically, some of the exhibits were suggesting that the orthodox theory finds its support in a certain kind of logic. Vain dialogues. You follow me? Certain kind of logic rather than scientific evidence. A report in Nature quoted what one of the museum's senior scientists was telling the public in a film lecture. How dare, at this very opening in the National Museum, this guy says this in a film lecture for the poor people out there that are not elite enough to understand these possible little anomalies, and they're being told this. Quote, "The survival of the fittest is an empty phrase. It's a play on words." I mean, we're exposing the public to this, knocking a hole in the whole foundation of our tunnel of existence, this fact that we've been proclaiming until you're either insane or an idiot or wicked or ignorant to not believe it. And here, for the public to see, one of the museum senior scientists is telling the public in a film lecture, "The survival of the fittest is an empty phrase. It's a play on words." For this reason, many critics feel that not only is the idea of evolution unscientific, but the idea of natural selection also. There's no point in asking whether or not we should believe in the idea of natural selection, because it is the inevitable logical consequence of a set of premises. The idea of evolution by natural selection is a matter of logic, not science. And it follows that the concept of evolution by natural selection is not, strictly speaking, scientific. If we accept that evolution has taken place, though obviously we must keep an open mind on it, we can't prove that the idea is true, only that it has not yet been proved false. It may one day be replaced by a better theory, but until then, on it goes. The reporter commented, "If this is the voice of our friends and supporters, then creation protect us from our enemies." An editorial in Nature titled "Darwin's Death in South Kensington" hammered the offenders with the rhetorical question, Can it be that the managers of the museum, which is the nearest thing to a citadel of Darwinism, have lost their nerve, not to mention their good sense? Nobody disputes that in the public presentation of science, it is proper, whenever appropriate, to say that disputed matters are in doubt, but is the theory of evolution still an open question among serious biologists? And if not, what purpose except general confusion can be served by these weasel words? I mean, the fight carried on and on and on until finally the offending material, as Anthony Flew, a philosopher renowned for defending Darwinism, atheism, and clear thinking, who explained the whole episode as a breach of trust by civil servants who had a duty to present the established truth rather than confuse the public with unorthodox opinions. And he reported the offending material has since, apparently and none too soon, been withdrawn. Now, when this author visited the museum in 1987, 6 years later, nice number, the exhibits contain nothing to alert the casual observer to the fact that there's anything controversial about Darwin's theory. For example, the infamous one possible explanation sign at the entrance to the Darwin exhibit had been replaced with the following reassuring message. When we compare ourselves with our fossil relatives, we find evidence that man has evolved. Darwin's work gave strong support to the view that all living things have developed into the forms we see today by a process of gradual change over very long periods of time. This is what we mean by evolution. Many people, find that the theory of evolution does not conflict with their religious beliefs. All the weasel words gone. That's the power of the intellectual elite, the power of the controllers. This is the foundation. Education bought it. The judges are schooled in that education. The media, if they have education, are schooled in it. And it is the fact. And we are the freaks out there who don't know better. Well, these icons, these marvelous substitutes, to show you that sense has been removed, and these are deliberate deceivers. The Miller-Urey experiment. Let me read. Many of you have bought this book, so you know. I only want to focus on deliberate deceit being offered by these people who have postulated out of their own brain their substitute for a creator. It's the product of their self-serving, vain ego. And their dialogue have created the icons. And they're not going to die easily. Let's take the Miller-Urey experiment. It is, obviously, a false picture designed and in textbooks to prove that life could spontaneously occur by chance. And it's in textbook after textbook, long after it's been proven, as the ability has developed scientifically to test the oxygen content of the oldest rocks, and there is absolutely no proof that there ever was an oxygen-free atmosphere. Indeed, every proof denies there ever was an oxygen-free atmosphere. And yet, in textbook after textbook, on page 24, you still find this lie from the non-God sense people who must carry forth their vain and empty and self-serving dialogues. Paul was a prophet. The March 1998 issue of National Geographic carries a photo of Miller standing next to his experimental apparatus. The caption reads, "Approximating conditions on the early Earth in a 1952 experiment. Stanley Miller, now at the University of California, San Diego, produced amino acids. Once you get the equipment together, it's very simple," he says. Several pages later, the National Geographic article explains, "Many scientists now suspect that the early atmosphere was different from what Miller first supposed. But a picture is worth a thousand words, especially when its caption is misleading and the truth is buried deep in the article. Even a careful reader is left with the impression that the Miller-Urey experiment showed how easy it was for life to originate on Earth. Many biology textbooks use the same misleading approach. The 2000 edition of Kenneth Miller and Joseph Levine's Biology, a popular high school textbook. Any of you teenagers have that textbook stuffed down your face, any of you? Remember, any teenagers in here take biology in high school? Did you ever see Miller and Levine's biology textbook? Not in their head. It's a popular high school textbook. It includes a drawing of the Miller-Urey apparatus. with the caption. By recreating the early atmosphere, ammonia, water, hydrogen, methane, and passing electric spark lightning through the mixture, Miller and Urey proved that organic matter such as amino acids could have formed spontaneously. 1998 college textbook, Life, the Science of Biology by William Purvis, Gordon Oryans, Craig Heller, and David Sadava, tells students that Stanley Miller, this is in 1998, the other one was 2000, Stanley Miller produced, quote, the building blocks of life using a reducing atmosphere such as existed on early Earth, and that no free oxygen was present in the early atmosphere. This textbook gives students no hint that most scientists now think the Miller-Urey experiment failed to simulate actual conditions in the early Earth. Even advanced college textbooks misrepresent the truth. The 1998 edition of Douglas Futima's Evolutionary Biology includes a drawing of the apparatus, quote, the apparatus Miller used to synthesize organic molecules under simulated early Earth conditions. The only thing Futima's book has to say about the controversy over primitive oxygen is that, quote, at the time of the earliest life, the atmosphere virtually lacked oxygen. And the latest edition of Molecular Biology of the Cell, a graduate level textbook by the National Academy of Sciences president, Bruce Alberts, and his colleagues, features the Miller-Urey apparatus and calls it a typical experiment simulating conditions on the primitive Earth. The accompanying text asserts that organic molecules, quote, are likely to have been produced under such conditions. The best evidence for this comes from the laboratory experiments. And on through the National Academy of Science, papers and booklets. We're teaching our biology students mythology rather than science. And that's only one of them. I close by taking you to the phrases at the end of this piece of paper I've handed out. God not only withdraws the God sense and they turn their mind and their mouth into creating self-aggrandizing, self-created dialogues, and they have won the day. They are the elite of education, law, and science. And like a body of common law that builds up for years and judges hate to contest a decision already made, nobody has the courage. One woman from China was going to present arguments against Darwinism at a national meeting. And she was advised not to do it. If she wanted any grants or fundings or positive response, she says, isn't it amazing? In China, we can criticize Darwinism and cannot criticize the government. In America, you can criticize the government, but you can't criticize Darwinism. Not only did God withdraw sense from them, and we see these professed sophists becoming morons, he does something worse. He does something much worse. He takes and literally hurls them into the control of another force. The word, wherefore God also gave them up. See that? I've circled it. And drawn down to paradokanautos, which literally is, therefore, handed over them. The God handed over them to unclean forces. The King James reads differently, but it is impurity, as the translation lots of times used, or uncleanness. But the leper would say, unclean, unclean. It is more than just lack of purity. It's hurled into the force, equivalent to being placed in a situation of infectious disease. A force greater than you, if you're exposed to it without protection, without inoculation, without the barriers, that force can infect you. That's the uncleanness and the impurity. Not only does God take a sense away from you, which is a capacity to see God, He then turns you over to a force field in effectual uncleanness. Three times He says it. 26th verse. Handed them over to passions of dishonor. And again, passions hardly does it in the English. I'll go on in this as we now move on in Romans. And the third time, three times, He doesn't just withdraw. He doesn't just leave them alone. He literally hands them over to infectious forces, passions of dishonor, forces that produce dishonor, and hands them over to forces of a pervert or disapproved mind. He doesn't just now withdraw the capacity to see God. He hands you over to these force fields of evil passion, infectious uncleanness, perverted brain. Let me elaborate and I'm done. I've written it there for you. There's some clear illustrations of the power of this word, the verb of which, paradidomai. Mark 14 is translated betrayed, where Judas betrayed Jesus to the Roman soldiers. But by the kiss and the identification, he handed Jesus over to the Roman soldiers. Not just a denial of Jesus, but an act which resulted in capture. Mark 15. Jesus, the same word is used there, and it's translated handed over. Jesus is handed over by the Sanhedrin to Pilate. Luke 23. Jesus is delivered up or handed over by Pilate to the will of the people. And in Mark 15, Jesus is handed over to the soldiers to be executed. Don't think you get off having defied God and the knowledge that He's given you, and you trivialize it and don't recognize Him and worship Him and live a life of thanksgiving before Him. He withdraws the God sense, and your mouth and your brain becomes an instrument of self-defense, self-aggrandizement, self-inflation, and you use this wonderful gift that could praise God in thinking to create icons productive of self-worship. Your brain bleeps. But worse than that, not only has sense been withdrawn until this wondrous gift does nothing but inflate yourself and your ideas, He turns you over to infectious forces of uncleanness and anti-godness, and cleanness has nothing to do. It's an uncleanness that cannot be washed in a tub, a spa, or a shower. It's infectious forces that invade, demonic powers. I've said it over and over. You're either going to choose God or the prince of this world. And as Ephesians says, when we're discovered and rescued, we were living according to the children of this world, under the guidance of the prince of this world, and living as those that were under the spirit of disobedience. You are turned over to forces, infectious, anti-God, spiritual uncleanness, turned over to passions of dishonor, self-serving lusts, and third, a perverse brain. Not just one that can't see God, but one that is caught up in forces anti-God. And that's what's being illustrated in these mindsets and words of these otherwise brilliant men who have turned their back and not only rule God out of the equation, they won't have Him. He will call you ignorant, insane, or wicked to even bring His name up. A terrible state to be in. Verse of worshiping and thanking the God who gave Himself for us and merely wants us to trust Him, worship Him, thank Him, and live a life from faith to faith. You gotta be, I'll borrow from Dawkins, you don't gotta be, you are ignorant, insane, and wicked to turn your back on a Creator and follow these idiot paths that are sold to you with cheap hucksterism, unworthy of a carnival, as facts instead of being theory. Break out of the tunnel and go from faith to faith, and that's my message. Time.